Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wildlife conservationist Alan Rabinowitz travels the world saving animals and their ecosystems, from Belize, where he set up the first ever jaguar sanctuary, to now Myanmar, where he's behind the world's largest tiger preserve. The New York Times called him the Indiana Jones of wildlife science. He's been in plane crashes, negotiated with hostile governments, and encountered just about every disease and parasite imaginable. This hour, On Point, deep into the jungles of Myanmar, saving the last of the world's tigers. And joining me right now in the studio is Alan Rabinowitz. He's Executive Director of the Science and Exploration Division for the Wildlife Conservation Society based at the Bronx Zoo in New York. He's worked all over the world, from Central America, that is, to Asia. Most recently, he's been in Myanmar, where he worked with the military government and the native tribes to create the world's largest tiger reserve. And he's the author of numerous books. His latest chronicles his time in Myanmar. It's called Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed. Alan, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, you must probably hate the fact that the New York Times ever called you the Indiana Jones of wildlife science, but how did that moniker come about, and you think it's pretty accurate?
Well, it seems to have stuck to me, whether I like it or not.
I think your publicist loves it.
Yes, I think so. To me, it doesn't really accurately describe what I do because I don't seek adventure, although adventure usually follows me where I go, because part of my job is to look for the world's wildest places and to assess what species are left in those places and to try to protect the world's wild areas while we still can. Consequently, in doing that, there's no shortage of adventures, sometimes quite life-threatening.
You grew up in New York City. I think you told one of our staffers, how does a nice Jewish boy end up in the jungles of Myanmar? But how did you get to Thailand and Borneo and Myanmar, ended up trying to save tigers and jaguars?
That is quite a funny story in some ways, because growing up in New York City, I actually never even saw a cow until I went to college in Maryland.
I knew what the exotic cow was.
The exotic cow. My introduction into the world of animals came through something quite personal and unlike probably how many people in my field got there. I was a severe stutterer as a child. It was so bad that I couldn't get words out. I had severe blockages. At that time in the New York City public school system, they didn't quite know what to do with severe stutterers, just like they didn't have words or descriptions for children with ADD or dyslexia or many things we understand now today. So they put all of us in special classes, which the other children would always refer to as the retarded classes. So from kindergarten until sixth grade, I essentially was put into special classes for special needs children and viewed by the outside world as if I was handicapped, mentally handicapped, because at that time they believed stuttering was completely psychological, which we know is not true now. So I decided just to stop talking. I decided to feed into that. If people wouldn't make the effort to understand me, I wouldn't even make an effort to try to be understood, and I stopped speaking. The amazing thing is with stuttering is that stutterers can do two things without stuttering. One is sing, and the other is speak to animals.
Speak to animals.
Speak to animals, because animals are not judging you in any way. So every day I would go home, I would be mute all day among human beings, viewed one way. Then I would go home, I'd go into the darkness of my closet, I would bring my little green turtle or chameleons or garter snake, whatever I had at the time, and I would talk, and I would that's the only time I would speak, and I could
without
speak
stuttering
to them. I still stuttered some when I spoke to the animals, but not very much. But I could be me. I could be who I was.
How did you go from lizards and small animals to jaguars and tigers?
Well, I wasn't really ever it's not as if I imagined I would always do that, because I didn't know that world even existed. I just swore when I was very young, I realized that animals were like me in that they had feelings and emotions and thoughts, and they couldn't speak either. And if animals could speak, perhaps people wouldn't treat them the way that they did, flushing them down the toilet if they were tired of them or euthanizing them. So I remember very clearly swearing to myself as a child that if I ever could get my voice back, that I would try to be the voice for animals. And I tried living by that. There were times when I thought maybe I'll go into medicine or some other field, but I always steered away from the human fields to that of trying to help and save animals. And I just pushed for it all my life.
And your most recent cause is tigers. Are they on the decline? Or they have been on the decline, I guess, for a number of years. But what are the numbers involved?
Oh, tigers are in horrible shape. Tigers, of all the big cats, tigers are in the worst shape. They are down to only 3% of their historic range. 97% of their range now is gone. But the good news is that 3% is still hundreds of thousands of square miles. Numbers, they're down to maybe 3,000 to 4,000 tigers in the wild, which may sound like a lot to some, but not compared to the fact that by the beginning of the 20th century, they were at approximately 100,000. Now we have just a few fragmented populations remaining.
Let's talk about Myanmar. You went there for the first time in 1993. It's not exactly a tourist mecca. How did you get inside the country?
It wasn't easy. I tried for years, as other biologists did as well, to get into Myanmar and to explore some of the rugged existing forests that to biologists was considered kind of the heart of darkness. I constantly wrote the government. They never returned any of my faxes, never answered any of my letters. So one day I decided to get a 2-week visa and enter the country as a tourist, break away from the tourist guide who was assigned to me by the government, and make my way over to the forestry department on my own.
Well, first of all, what is it about Myanmar? By the way, it used to be called Burma back in the day, but now Myanmar. What is it about that country, parts of it, that are so pristine or such valuable pieces of the environment for animal and wildlife?
Well, Myanmar, the fact that it has been relatively closed to the outside world and that its development has been stymied for decades has actually been of benefit to the forests and the wildlife, to the point where that country currently has the largest amount of standing forest, the greatest species diversity, and the greatest species endemism of any country in the Indo-Pacific region. So to a biologist, this was Asia's gold mine for species, or trying to find new species and set up new protected areas. It also had the least number of protected areas of any country in the whole region, and one of the smallest in the entire world. So I was drawn to this like a moth to a flame.
And what about tigers? Tigers aren't native just to Myanmar, but other countries as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. They exist in, I think, 11 countries right now. The largest number of living tigers are in India, but they were almost gone from most of the other range countries. And what was thought at the time, before I got into Myanmar, was that possibly in this country was the second greatest population outside of India. So we had to try to investigate them and save them.
And so what convinced you that the wildlife, not just the tigers, but all of the environment there, was something that's worth saving?
Well, it didn't take long. During my earliest expeditions into the far north of the country, an area called the Kachin State, I discovered a completely new species of deer to science called the leaf deer by the local people. It was so small, stands about 2 feet at the shoulder. It's the smallest, most primitive deer in the entire world, and it's called leaf deer because the people can wrap its whole body when they kill it inside of one large leaf. We discovered 4 other new species during that time, and there were tiger tracks everywhere I looked in one particular valley. The bad news was that tigers had been killed from most of the country. The good news was that there was one particular hidden valley that very few people had ever gotten to, called the Hukong Valley, that the local people called the Valley of Death, where there were still tigers, mainly because people were terrified of going in there.
Well, we'll talk more about the tigers in a little bit more, or rather the Hukong Valley in a little bit. But you mentioned that you actually discovered new species. That not many people can say that. Were you able to name it after yourself or anything?
I would have liked to. It would have been perhaps the first Jewish deer in the world. No, usually among scientists with mammals, new mammal species, we try not to name it after people anymore. We try as hard as possible to give it a local name.
And you also, ran into a group of pygmies. Now, people mostly associate pygmies with Africa, don't
they?
That's
right. But these are the world's only known mongoloid pygmies, the only Asian race of pygmies up in the high Tibetan area. They were true pygmies. I didn't discover them. They were discovered actually in the early 60s, written about in Nature, but then forgotten by the outside world until we got to them in the 1990s.
How small are they?
By definition, they're all below 5 feet. They were all about 4'8 to 4'11, and they were a dying race. There were only 12 pure ones left when I got to them.
And how do they think about, you said something in your book about how they didn't look very cautiously, very optimistically toward the future for
no,
their race.
No, well, they were very beleaguered people. And they had actually, I couldn't understand for the life of me why only 12 of them still existed when hundreds had been existing in the 60s. But they were going downhill very rapidly from disease and other maladies.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook. Alan Rabinowitz is with us. He's the Executive Director of the Science and Exploration Division for the Wildlife Conservation Society. He's worked to set aside conservation land from Belize to Borneo. His most recent book about his adventures in Myanmar is titled Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed. And I should say you could find photos from Alan's time in Myanmar on our website, and that's at onpointradio.org. Alan, a moment ago you talked about the Hukong Valley, which is probably little known to most of America, but tell us about its rich history, and I guess it came into prominence, especially during World War II?
I was amazed to find out that this small, remote part of the earth played such a major role during World War II. It only was a bit later, after I started getting interested in Hukong Valley for the tigers, that I realized that anybody who knew the history of World War II and was a World War II aficionado would know the name of Hukong Valley well. When the Japanese took over the Burma Road and locked out the Allied forces, blocking them from supplying Chiang Kai-shek, they almost knocked China out of the war. That could have lost all of Indochina for the Allies and actually could have helped turn the war around at that time. So the Allied forces knew that they had to keep Burma in order to try to keep India and China both. To make a long story short, they realized that in order to supply the Allied forces in China, they first tried flying airplanes over what was called the infamous hump, which is also part of Hukong Valley, but too many planes went down.
Mountains?
Rugged. It's actually part of the Himalayas. So over 600 planes went down in those mountains, Allied planes. Finally, the British tried to build a road through the Hukong Valley to rehook up with the Burma Road and resupply the Chinese, but they couldn't do it. They considered it too rough. Winston Churchill said it was impossible. And then a very fiery American general named General Joe Stilwell said that they would do it. The Americans built the road. It's called the Stilwell Road or the Lido Road, penetrating Hukong Valley, and it is still there to this day. It was the main access point for me to actually enter into this valley and survey for tigers.
Although it turned out not to be terribly critical because of the timing of the war.
It was finished. It cost over $100 million in the currency of the time, and it was finished 2 weeks before the end of the war, and only one convoy passed over it.
What about the name, the Valley of Death? Is that referring to, well, tell me what it's referring to.
Well, the Hukong Valley itself, I learned, is a local name for meaning cremation grounds. It was called Valley of Death by the local people because of all of the killing which happened there, predating World War II, but then just added to by all the killing by the fighting in World War II. And on top of that, It turns out that, those jungles have the worst malaria of any place in the entire country. So many people without medicine die back there every year.
And when you finally gained permission to get into that valley, you had military government officials with you all the time. And this is, of course, a very strict regime that's in place in Myanmar. What was that like?
Well, I had gotten used to it by then. I'd been in the country since 1993 by then, and everywhere I went, military usually accompanied me. By the time I went into Hukong Valley, it wasn't quite as bad as always. They were more fearful of my dying than of anything. Of all the trips I had taken in Myanmar, they made me sign a release form for going into Hukong Valley, saying that if I died, that they weren't responsible for it.
Well, let's open up the conversation to our callers. Carl is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Tell us what's on your mind.
I spend probably two or three times a year I go over into Thailand, and we work with a hill tribe in the Burmese and Thailand area. They're called the Karen people. And when we go over into Burma and stuff, we see a lot of, you know, tiger skins and tiger teeth and bones and that sort of thing for sale. And the people don't really seem to hold the tigers in that high of a regard. You know, they don't really view them as being important. And I want to see if Alan had seen that. And also the military regime, I noticed that he had said that he had a tough time getting in at first, just from the government. And I know that the Karen people that we work with, they've had a tough time with the military regime over the, you know, decades. And I want to see if that was a thing for him as well, as far as the military not really holding the tiger, like, you know, not the tigers weren't important to them. I want to see if he saw that at all.
Thanks, Carl.
That's a very good question. You clearly know the area. I know the Karen people well. In fact, it's not in the area where I set up the tiger reserve, which is the home of the Kachin people. But in fact, we are now the only other place in the entire country with a population of tigers, which we are trying to save, is in the Karen area, in the Taninterai region, the Tenasserim range, along the Thai-Burmese border, the area where you are talking about. What you say is so true, and many people don't realize it. It's not just that many people think, well, the government has no respect for the animals, but the local people do, and if we let the local people take care of it, they will ensure the survival of the wildlife. Unfortunately, it's not a question of anybody being bad or good. It's just a question of people having to survive and do what they have to do in any way they can in a very poor country to survive. Consequently, they're all killing tigers. All the local people are killing tigers and selling them over the border to the Chinese. And the military have often been killing tigers in the past. Fortunately, when I was able to show data, show the heads of the military government that they would soon be losing all their tigers unless something was done to at least save two of their major populations, one in the area you're talking about and up in the Hukong Valley, then we were going to lose everything. And the military didn't want to lose all their tigers. They respected tigers, or they liked tigers enough to say, okay, tell us what you need and we will try to help you save tigers. When I went to the local people, because just having the military say it won't make it true, then we worked with the local people, the Kachin, and now we're working with the Karen. They want to save tigers, but they say, we need money. We need assistance. If you want us to protect our wildlife, show us how we could do it in a way that benefits us. And that's a very fair claim. So much of our efforts now, in order to save tigers, are actually going towards improving the livelihoods of the local communities so that they don't have to kill tigers. It doesn't mean I'm going to be able to stop all the tiger hunting or all the poaching going on, but for the most part, if we can stop enough of the hunting, especially of the tiger's food, sambar, deer, and pig, tigers will come back.
You write pretty extensively in your book about your trip to the valley and the town of Tanai and then beyond. What was that experience like, meeting the people, the wildlife, meeting with the local residents there, as well as the rebels, I guess, the Kia group?
the KIA, the Kachin Independent Army. It's always a challenge, but I love it. This is the part about my work. Apart from actually seeing wildlife and watching animals, the part I love most is trying to deal with the mosaic of people, the different cultures and the different needs, and how to figure out a way that all of these different needs can be met, because we have to do it. It's not a matter of choice. If we're going to save wildlife, especially the big things like tigers and Asian elephants, we need to figure out not just how to make new protected areas, because we're seeing, such as in India, that doesn't always work. You have to stop locking people out and locking animals in and try to figure out how wildlife and humans can coexist. So doing conservation in the human landscape is the biggest challenge of my life.
You talk about your travels as being terribly treacherous at times, and you mentioned leeches. I mean, that's something that everybody recoils at when they hear mentioned. But what was that like for you?
I love leeches.
Oh,
leeches,
you're the one.
Leeches are the thing. When you work in the jungles or in the wild enough, anything that can't hurt you, you savor. You don't mind whatsoever.
They suck your blood, right?
They suck your blood, but they don't carry any diseases. So they're very, I don't mind leeches. What you have to be careful of is the wounds they open up can be prone to infection. But I actually don't mind leeches whatsoever, because they don't carry things. We're much more wary of the mosquitoes and the ticks, frankly.
And how rugged were the traveling conditions?
They were pretty rugged. It's all relative, I guess, but they were difficult. The terrain was very treacherous and very rugged, but the biggest fear I always have is from diseases, frankly, carried by the mosquitoes mostly.
Mm. Let's go to another call. Eric is on the line from New Russia, New York. Hi, Eric.
Hi, James. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Alan, I just finished Life in the Valley of Death last night. And I'm a great fan of your work. And in the early 90s, I read Jaguar and was inspired to go to Belize and was lucky enough to glimpse a jaguar.
Wow.
And was told I was very fortunate in that light. I'm wondering how the most recent political events in Myanmar affect the possibility for tourism for ecotourism there at this point, and generally how important tourists and tourism dollars are to your conservation efforts?
That's an excellent question. Whenever I set up the reserves, and especially in Hukong Valley, I always kept in mind tourism. It wasn't so clear to me when I set up the Jaguar Preserve, because ecotourism wasn't even a term back then, but I always thought about nature tourism and people coming because of the wildness and to have and feel the same feeling I had and you clearly had. I'm sure that you had an unbelievable surge go through you when you glimpsed a jaguar, one of the most spectacular experiences you could possibly have for that mysterious cat. In Myanmar, ecotourism had been picking up prior to the U.S. sanctioning the country. Now it's become much more difficult, and with recent events, even more difficult. Though tourists can go there, you can get permission to travel to all of the areas where I've set up the protected areas, because that actually opens them up for tourism. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to develop the Hukong Valley yet, like I would like to. It has great potential for people coming in and riding domestic elephants. And when the tigers start coming back, as they will, I think people will be able to see tigers the way you were able to experience jaguars in the Coxcomb Basin. That kind of economic input, but even more importantly, the idea of the Hukong Valley becoming high priority in the minds of people internationally, that will help to protect that area long into the future. It's very important, as you've picked up on.
There are, according to your book, several populations in the Hukong Valley, several indigenous populations. They all relate to the wildlife differently. I guess there's the Naga, the Lisu, the Kachin, and the Shan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How did that affect the tiger population management, the fact that there are all these disparate groups?
Well, the different groups view the tiger in different ways. The earlier caller picked up on some of that. Some of the groups seem to show no respect whatsoever for the tiger, and they will just kill it very quickly and blatantly, whereas some others, like the Naga, they're fascinating because the tiger is very imbued in their cultural beliefs and in their shamanistic rituals. They believe that tigers could be the spirit or may have the spirit of some of their ancestors. So killing a tiger could bring very bad fortune to them if it's one of their ancestors. Consequently, Naga, though they do still kill tigers sometimes, they're much more careful and much more reticent about killing tigers. Whereas the Lisu, they're considered the best hunters of all the tribes in the entire country. They will get on the track of a tiger, and they will stay with it until they get it, often living for weeks in the forest. So how I deal with the different tribes is very different depending on what their cultural beliefs are.
And, you know, part of your book here that we have an excerpt of deals with a conversation you had with a member of the Lisu tribe. You were trying to convince them to see the, I guess you would call, the error of their ways, or to try to prevent them from killing more tigers. And I guess you had a moment of realization with this one tribal member. Would you mind reading a little bit for us?
No, I would be happy to. Let me just set this up a little. The Lisu, by the time I had been in the Hukong Valley for several years, I realized that I could figure out ways of getting to almost everybody and to try to have them not kill wildlife and not kill tigers. There were different things that people wanted. But the Lisu stymied me. Killing tigers was such a part of their tradition. It gave them status, and they could make a lot of money for it. There was almost no way I could figure out to try to change them as hard as I could. There were gold minings, and the Lisu went after anything for money, but hunting was always a primary part of their way of life.
So here's the excerpt, yeah?
"Do the Lisu dig for gold?" I ask. "Sometimes, but many Lisu get money by hunting and selling the meat in the camps. Now some start shops like mine," he says proudly. "Now you also work for us," I say. "Sometimes," he smiles. "Mint Mong complains that Apu simply packs up and disappears when something else strikes his fancy. Can we stop the Lisu from killing tiger and other animals in here? Will you help us do that?" I ask. "If Lisu can kill a tiger, they will kill it," he replies honestly. "There is not much I can do. They make good money from the traders." He stands and walks to his hut a short distance away. I follow. Inside the hut, Apu stokes the coals in the hearth to boil water for tea. As the fire comes to life, the light from the flames illuminates an extensive collection of animal skulls attached to a bamboo frame on one of the walls. I've seen this kind of trophy board many times before during our hikes up north. The Lisu believe that if they save and respect the skulls of their kills, they will have better luck in hunting that same species in the future. The idea is not far removed from the Naga belief that you consume a killed animal's life force when you eat it. What does everyone do back here during the rainy season, I ask. Before last year, not so many people came in here, especially during the rains. Travel is hard. Many people get sick and die. Now at the road, it's better, he says. Is everything better for you now? Apu's quiet for a moment.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today with wildlife biologist Alan Rabinowitz about his time in Myanmar. He's executive director of the Science and Exploration Division for the Wildlife Conservation Society. He's out with a new book about his time in Myanmar. It's called Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed. This is also a land where, as we've mentioned, is controlled by an authoritarian regime. You had to deal with them pretty closely. First of all, did you see that authoritarianism up close, firsthand?
I actually didn't see much of that. People ask me all the time, how could I work in such a country? Part of it is I don't see what many people are saying is occurring. Maybe it's not happening in front of me, or it's happening in different places. I would view some of it, such as people building roads, a village being told they might have to build a certain amount of road during a certain time period. But the military I worked with and the things we did in the forest, that was so far removed from the central government, Yangon, that I didn't see any form of abuse or anything.
They weren't out corralling Buddhist monks in the jungles, obviously.
No, and actually, I wasn't even in the country when that affair occurred.
Yeah. But you did have to deal with the government people. How were you able to do this? Was it difficult, and how long did it take to convince them to allow you to do your work?
It was difficult at first because they didn't trust me. They believed that, like so many other foreigners, I was there with some other agenda that was primarily political. And it took quite a few years for them to figure that I was only out there to save wildlife and in the best interests of what was good for the country. Once they did that, they embraced what I did pretty openly, and they have the military junta has actually been very helpful to me in setting up this tiger preserve.
Why do you think that is?
Well, a lot of people ask me that. Some people think that they use me for political gain, but I don't see how that can be when they have never once advertised or tried to get out word of what I'm doing. All the advertisement about the tiger preserve comes from me, not from them. They don't see gaining any points from international arena. I think it's because they just don't want to see tigers go extinct in Myanmar.
So when you first approached the government, you wrote a letter to one of the top officials, and then you actually got a meeting. I don't know if that was a surprise or not. Tell us about that meeting and how your interaction played out.
Well, my first meeting with the Minister of Forestry, which took many years to get permission because he's one of the generals of the ruling military junta. Again, he was very suspicious of my motives, and clearly they had done a full background check on me and my family.
He thought you were a spy?
I never got there. Well, I just think they check out every foreigner who wants to meet high officials like that. So I'm not sure if he thought I was a spy, but he did say that I didn't look like a scientist. I'm not sure what a scientist is supposed to look like. Once we were able to break through that ice, he became very friendly, and in actuality, we became friends eventually.
Did they actually have a plan for managing tiger populations before you arrived, or was it just in disarray?
No, they not only didn't have a plan, but they assumed that because they had large amounts of forest, that they still had fairly good numbers of tigers. They didn't know how bad the tiger population was.
Why was the government so eager to save them? You think you know the answer? I mean, you think it's truly in their heart?
There's no other reason I can come to. They gain no international dollars from it because no international funding comes to Myanmar. They gain no credibility from it because every time they try to say they're doing something good, the international media just points to all the bad things they're doing. So there's nothing they're gaining, obviously, from it. When I speak to them, and I ask them why they do it, I've asked all of the generals who I've encountered why they're doing it. Some of them don't care, frankly. There are quite a few generals there. But some of them, especially the ones in power, in charge of the forestry department and some of the highest officials, they think tigers are part of the Burmese heritage, an important part, and they feel that if the tigers disappear, then a very crucial part of Burma will disappear.
How big is this reserve? It's a pretty big chunk of land out there.
Almost 8,500 square miles. It's about the size of the state of Vermont, larger than some small countries. It's huge.
And is it going to expand?
It could expand, frankly. It's already connected to an already existing area, the largest tiger reserve in India, on the other side of the border. So it's actually connected to a lot of other protected forest.
So initially, is that the size of the preserve you initially sought?
I saw it 9,000 square miles, and I only got 8,500 square miles.
Well, not a bad deal, huh?
No, that's not.
But is there a request now to expand it?
Well, what you're saying actually has more than one answer. When I first went there in there to seek out a protected area, the area I originally asked for was only 2,500 square miles, and the government gave me that. They acceded to that request, and that got set up as the Hukong Valley Wildlife Sanctuary for tigers. But then we expanded that to 8,500 square miles.
Okay, so they said, hey, take this instead.
Almost.
Let's go to callers. Steve is on the line from Wacobuc, New York. Steve, hi.
Yeah, hi, James, Alan. Steve from Wacobuc, New York, yeah. Quick observation. When I was a boy, I lived in Indonesia and Sumatra in the rainforest, and lots of big cats around, medium size and small. I did see a tiger being skinned and for a trophy. A lot of the white foreigner guys look for the opportunity to bag a big cat. You know, it's a big deal. I was hugely impressed when I was a boy watching that skinning and all day. But it was, you know, quite gut-wrenching, more than just the guts, you know. But my other question is, what about protection of big cats these days internationally and in the United States? I have a leopard skin rug from back when I was a kid in India. And how do people properly dispose of or, you know, sell them or whatever these days? What's the protection on big cats?
Thanks, Steve.
There is a convention in place. By the way, you were very lucky to see the Sumatran tiger, as you probably know, it sounds like you're well informed, is now one of the more endangered of the subspecies. It's really suffering in Sumatra, but we have some very strong projects trying to save the Sumatran tiger also. There are laws in place, and one of the strongest is a convention called CITES. It's the Convention on Trade for Endangered Species. And the United States and many other countries are signatories to that. It is not easy, although it's done all the time, but it's not legal to bring in endangered parts of any endangered species, such as tigers now. However, parts of non-endangered species can be brought in with special permits. Unfortunately, leopards falls into that category. If you wish to dispose of something that you already have that may have come in when it was legal, the best way I know of people having done that is to donate it to something like a museum or school programs or other facilities which actually have use for such things to use them as educational tools to teach young people and adults about these cats and about endangered species.
Let's go to another call. Lou is calling from Goshen, Connecticut. Lou.
Do you ever run into any danger being in tiger country from tigers itself?
Excuse me, could you repeat that? I wasn't sure I understood.
Yes.
That.
Have you ever run into any danger from tigers themselves being in tiger country?
Thanks, Lou.
Well, I've run into much more danger in my life from human beings than from tigers. The most dangerous animal out there, which comes as no surprise to most people, are the human beings. But there were some very scary close calls with tigers. One in particular is when I was tracking a tiger. Actually, this happened to me in Thailand, not in Burma. I was tracking a tiger in the jungles of Thailand, and it was very, very fresh track and very fresh scat, so much so that I felt if I just got a little closer, I'd be able to see the tiger. And I kept on going and going and going for about 3 hours until it was starting to get dark, and I realized that if I didn't turn around and go back to camp, I'd be trying to get back to camp in the jungle without a light in the dark, not something you really want to be doing. So I turned around, and just as I turned around, there's the tiger in back of me. And I I didn't know right away that that was the same tiger. I would find out that later, but I thought it was. The tiger had circled around and was following me for a good part of the way as I thought I was following it. When I first saw it, I didn't quite know what to do, so I squatted down trying to become subdominant or not so the tiger wouldn't be afraid.
Did you think you were about to become dinner?
I didn't, you know, no, I didn't. But it's just such a humbling experience because the tiger's so big compared to you. And I realized that there was nothing I could have done. If I had run away, if I had done anything, that tiger could have gotten me. So the tiger sat down after I sat down and we both looked at each other for about 20 seconds. And then the tiger just stood up and walked away into the forest. I was fairly shaken, I have to tell you. It was a pretty scary moment, but also I was in complete awe. When I backtracked, I saw that the tiger's tracks overlapped mine and that it had cut in from the forest and it was the same tiger that I had been following. That tiger could have killed me at any time it wanted, and I would never have known what was coming. It just was following me out of curiosity. Big cats, yes, they are dangerous, of course. But like so many animals, the big cats don't want to hurt you unless they feel threatened themselves.
You talked about how stuttering sort of sparked your interest with animals back as a kid. But there's another health issue that you're dealing with now. You've been diagnosed with leukemia,
terminal leukemia.
And I'm wondering how that gives you a little different perspective in how you deal with tigers and other wildlife and trying to help them out.
Well, that's changed things quite a bit for me. I was diagnosed in 2001 with a chronic form of leukemia called CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It's a strange one because on the one hand, doctors think it's a good form of cancer, if you can call any cancer that, because it's slow. You have a lot of time until bad things start to occur. But on the other hand, it's one of the incurable forms of leukemia. So there's no cure for it. So they won't treat me until something gets really bad. Before I was diagnosed, I was in my late 40s. I was turning 50 soon, and I was thinking that I was starting to get tired, that this maybe the tiger reserve in Burma would be my swan song, that I had done enough. And I have two small children, and I wanted to spend more time with my children. So I actually had dreams or thoughts of retirement of some sort, or maybe a house on a lake somewhere. After I was diagnosed with leukemia, all those thoughts flew out the window immediately. I thought that in the best of circumstances, maybe I will have 5 to 10 more good years of good field work, and that the clock was ticking louder than I'd ever heard it ticking before. So now now it's like I'm young again, really. Now I have all my energy back surging through me, determined to do as much as I can for the tigers and the jaguars and the other big cats while I still can. And more than anything, looking for young people to mentor to carry on this fight once I can no longer do it.
Are you planning to go back to Myanmar?
Absolutely. I'd be there now if not for this book coming out. I will go back in February, back to the reserve.
And what work remains to be done?
Well, you have to always make sure. The only way conservation succeeds is with constant vigilance. You can never think that it's a war which is won or that you've accomplished it and you can walk away, because there will always be crises. And most of the constant vigilance has to come with the local people. I want to make sure that they're actually benefiting from the reserve and not being harmed by it. The most important thing, both for the sustainability of the tiger reserve and from my own conscience and what I want to accomplish, is that local people who are being asked to live with wildlife like tigers, that their lives become better for it. They actually feel good about living inside the tiger reserve because now their children are getting better benefits. Now their health is better. I have to make sure that they are benefiting and that their lives are better and that it's not somehow sinking into a regime to where they're going back to their old ways.
Has your work in preserving wildlife helped you in your battle with leukemia?
Well, it's helped me mentally, if not physically. It's not done anything to slow the progression of the disease physically, but mentally, yes. I feel very at peace. I've been in so many close calls in terms of dying. I've been in a plane crash, helicopter crash, bungee sticks going through my foot. So many near-death experiences over the years that it's not dying per se that I fear. It's just the quality of my life that is all important to me.
Are you comforted at all that you'll leave a bit of legacy in the countries that you visited?
Think about that. People ask me, what do you think of all the things you've accomplished? And I honestly never sit back and think of what I have accomplished, because every waking moment, all I'm consumed about is how much work there still is out there to do and how much needs to get done.
And just quickly, what other projects are you working on?
Well, apart from this huge jaguar, this small country, which is a tiger reserve, the biggest project in my life, which will probably take what remains of it, is a jaguar corridor, an intact genetic corridor for jaguars from Mexico through Argentina. That is coming along very well also and is consuming everything.
Well, we expect to hear a lot more about that in the coming months and years, hopefully.
Thank you.
Alan Rabinowitz, Executive Director of the Science and Exploration Division for the Wildlife Conservation Society. His new book is Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed. Alan, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and find a photo gallery from Alan Rabinowitz's time in Myanmar. That's all on our website at onpointradio.org. I'm James Satori, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thank you.